Thank you. I'm a little concerned. I've been following people who are obviously very involved in the organizations that they're representing here today. I happen to be one of the member representatives to DataCite, and I'm not intricately involved with the development and day-to-day operations. So I'm going to do the best job I can in talking to you about DataCite. And I also realize that I am the last speaker that stands between you and lunch, and I'm very aware of it myself. So let's see, which button do I hit? Oh, just the space bar? Okay. This past summer, I guess actually a year ago now, we had a conference at Purdue that was focusing on e-science. And one of the keynote speakers was Arden Bement, the former director of the National Science Foundation. In fact, he had just retired that month. And he gave this interesting analogy about data, and that he's a mining engineer. He's now a nuclear engineer, and he's now at Purdue directing our Global Policy Research Institute. But he talked about data being in three formats, the raw ore, the concentrate, and the virgin metal. And what his point is that when you're smelting the ore and getting to the concentrate and then you get to the virgin metal, you have to decide what is that actual product that needs to be integrated, used, and preserved for the future. And that's the challenge that we all have in academia about what is the data that we will be preserving. Well, it doesn't take an astrophysicist or a biologist to know that there has been a large, large increase in the amount of data that's been generated. When I went to Purdue 8 years ago from MIT, I sat down and started talking to all the department heads and faculty, well, not all the faculty, but all the department heads, all 76 of them. It took me 2 years. And they constantly kept saying the biggest challenge they had was managing data. And it wasn't knowing where to put it. It was knowing how to get it out and how to access it and how to share it with other people. Obviously, and this was both small science and large science. It's the lifeblood for science and engineering research. Obviously, it's one of the reasons why it was such a critical initiative that NSF and NIH have both looked at challenges associated with making and mining data. We also, of course, use data for modeling, and the funding agencies look at public accessibility. I had the privilege about 6 years ago meeting with an NSF researcher who came to Purdue to assess what are the ways in which universities can become involved with data management. And we were the last people to meet with her at the end of the day, and she obviously had had ad nauseum presentations using PowerPoint. And she asked my associate dean and I, what are you talking about? Where's your PowerPoint? And we said, we aren't doing PowerPoint, we're just talking. And then she looked down and she said, oh, you're the librarians, you've got the answer. And I said, yes, but what's the question? And we started talking about the whole issue of data management. And she was very excited about the fact that at Purdue we were going to take this on as a major challenge for us to look at how to manage data. And then it dawned on me from the conversations that I'd already had with researchers that no two researchers really trusted each other's data. And I said, so what if we go through all this work, all this effort, and the researchers don't use it? And she said, that's going to require a change in the methodology, in the way research is undertaken. And that is accepting the fact that some data may have some contamination, and that you have to explore and build a model using that data with some contamination to indicate that that you're on the right track, and then possibly go back and pick up the data that is necessary to do the project. So what are the motivations that we have at DataCite? We are looking at, and I was very pleased to hear this morning that there is now an API that's going to link the DOIs contributed by or created by Crossref and those that are being created by DataCite, because there is a major organization within the U.S. that has assigned DOIs to DataCites through Crossref, and we're working with them now to determine how we incorporate their service or our service to them through provision of DOIs. And having the two now interact is greatly beneficial. And obviously, prior to this time, as I found out, there was no uniform way to identify data sets and no widely used method to cite data sets. Well, I don't have to tell you about Crossref. Obviously, it's a major, major success story, one that I think that if we look at publishing in the broadest sense and in information dissemination, I don't think anything could have had as big an impact and had such a comprehensive effect on our publishing world and the research world, the access, than what Crossref has been able to do. And at the bottom of this screen, obviously, is an article that has a DOI associated with it. But what about data? And DataCite was established in December of 2009, almost 2 years ago now, when a group of us from around the world came together to formalize an ad hoc group that had been working on the issues of data management, primarily from TIB in Germany, where Jan Brasse is located, and formalized our relationship, bringing as many of the countries of the world that we could into this initial organization. But we wanted to establish easier access to scientific research data on the internet, increase acceptance of research data as legitimate, citable contributions to scientific record. This is a very important factor. I sit on the University Promotion Committee at Purdue, and we never look at the data generated because it's not had the value in the scholarly record or the impact factor that it has, that it should be. And it's just now that we're starting to assume and assess that data should be and followed for its impact in the long-term publishing. It's a phenomenon that I think is not unlike other areas within which we've been doing research, and I think that it's going to is starting to have an impact as long as we can come up with citation factors. And we'll be able to support and repurpose for future study. The attribution of data, and this goes back to the ORCID. And I almost could have said that this complements Crossref, and it also complements ORCID. I'm very excited about what ORCID is doing. It's an issue that we run into constantly. My provost was talking about how his name, which is even a fairly uncommon name, he goes in and he can find five or six different Tim Sands in ISI. And he always has to look at them to make sure which one is him, or I guess he forgets what he's published. I hope not. But descriptive metadata, author, person, research variables, subject descriptors, disciplinary taxonomy, and then, of course, the digital object identifier, the persistent identifier. And here's the data set that goes with the previous article that I was showing. The provenance and citation is going to be critical, as I've already mentioned, that we do have to have the assignment of authorship. It goes back to the ORCID. Citation of data site, or the data set by research undertaken and reported through data site, and establishment of an H index for the data set impact. This is a screenshot that I just took off the web in the last week, and this shows a publication, Deep Sea Research, Oceanographic Research Papers by Elsevier. And it gives the view of the research article, and on the right is the data set that's connected to it. And I just stuck in the Crossref DOI on the top, and then the data set pointing to the left or right. I think that's your right. And then here's the data set when I clicked on the data set, which allows you then to see a description, understand why you might want to utilize that data set. Here are the data site members. And as you can see, we almost approximate what I think the map showed for orchid, and I probably assume, and I can't remember exactly for crossref, but very similarly for orchid. The only one I think that we don't show is Brazil, which we haven't been able to find a member there yet. But heavily North America, heavily Europe, and of course Australia and New Zealand. And typically, it's one library or one organization per country. There are only two countries that have more than one DataCite member who are actually agents for DataCite to assign DOIs, and that's Germany, where there are three national libraries representing science, technology, social sciences, and humanities. And so each one of those libraries has the role to assign DOIs for that specific discipline or those specific disciplines. And the U.S. In the U.S., we were allowed to do, at first, two data site agents, and that's the California Digital Library, CDL, of the University of California, and Purdue. The two of us were the first signers to the agreement, and we've worked out strong relationships between the two organizations. And then OSTI, the Office of Science and Technological Information from the Department of Energy, came in a year ago and has really hit the ground running by being able to assign DOIs to federal agencies. We also have affiliated members. And affiliated members are those who support the initiatives of DataCite. They are not willing or I suppose they could be willing, but they're not interested at this point, but wanting to show their support to the DataCite initiative, and that's the Digital Curation Center, Microsoft Research, Inter-University Consortium, and Korean Institute of Science and Technology Information, KISTI. Here's the data site structure and the United States. As I mentioned, we have the two, CDL and Purdue. We work together very closely. We are working together on the development of the EasyID system, which allows for easy download and access of DOIs assigning to various researchers, research projects, to universities. And we're doing this through a system that has been developed called EasyID. Not only does it sign a DOI, but it also signs an ARC. And then the other one is the Office of Science and Technology, OSTI. So just to remind you about why we're doing this is this quote again from Arden Bement about the fact that there is these three different levels of data. Now, people have asked me, is the assumption that if you assign a DOI through DataCite, that data set is going to reside and last forever? No, it isn't. That isn't logical. It's not feasible. But by registering the DOI with TIB, which is what will happen with every DOI that's assigned, that there is a permanent record of that data set either existing or having existed with this metadata, so that it won't necessarily always be able to provide you access to that data set, but it will give you the opportunity to see the description of it and know how that data, who developed that data set and where it originally was deposited. But in the libraries, we would love to be able to archive and store everything, but that's not going to be the case. We've also had people say, well, if I assign a DOI, does that mean that Purdue or CDL is going to store our data? No. We're going to be doing that for the organizations that we're responsible for, Purdue and California Digital, or the University of California, but the DOIs are a service that we are providing for the research community within the United States. We are now exploring the potential of being able to identify ourselves a bit better and calling ourselves the DataCite Alliance U.S., so that people will know that these three organizations work in tandem, and so that they don't have to try to figure out which one do I go to, that they will go to one site, and then through that site they'll be directed where they should go for their support for their assignment of DOIs. So I'll stop there and leave a bit of time for questions and hopefully answers.
I got this first as I was standing next to the person who had it. Bob Campbell from Wiley. That was a really interesting talk. Thank you very much. Two questions. One really hit me from your PowerPoints was there was the list of members, and they were all librarians and institutes of scientific information, technical information, and so on. I couldn't see any mention of the funders, and yet presumably this is really all about the ongoing value of what they have funded. So that seems to be an extraordinary omission, or is there a separate group related to you? That's one question. The second question is, hearing your talk, it was much nearer than I've heard from others in your field to Oldenburg's original four functions that we now quote a lot in relation to journal publishing, registration, certification, dissemination, and preservation. You seem to be hitting those functions, and also the fifth that's come in, metrics, a later function of journals. So you're seeing handling data following some of the principles of journal publishing. So two questions there.
Yes, I'll take the first one. The funding model, it varies depending upon where in the world the member locates. In Germany and primarily throughout Europe, British Library may be the exception, but primarily throughout Europe, it's being funded by the government and being funded as a service to the research community. In Canada and the U.S., that's not the case. We have to be self-supporting. Now, OSTI is a different case, and they can correct me because representatives from OSTI are here in the room. They are receiving their funding as part of their federal support. But for the CDL and for Purdue, we have to generate the income to cover our expenses. We have put expense in to the operation of developing. Purdue has committed staff, we've committed graduate assistants, research assistants in developing this in tandem with CDL. Ultimately, we hope to be able to recover some of that expense. But it's not a for-profit, but it's definitely a cost recovery that we have to operate. The second one, when you were talking about how we're assuming more of a relationship of publishing, that wouldn't be an incorrect assumption. Libraries have become much more involved in the publishing process. At Purdue specifically, our librarians are very much now a part of the research process. I have over 30 librarians working on 90 different research projects, grant-funded research projects from NSF, NIH, where the librarians are in there helping to manage the data from the very beginning. We have developed a repository called PER, Purdue University Research Repository, that is now up and running, that our faculty can deposit data, can create their team, deposit their data, and manage their data. And we'll move it through three different modules, from the sandbox to the publishing, where their data has been cleaned and ready for publication to their fellow researchers, and then to preservation. So that, yes, we are taking on that role and responsibility. It's not so much that we don't see an alternative to it. It's because we do see a real strong commitment to making sure that data management is done in compliance with the grants that are received by the university. When a grant is received, we submitted 65 grants this year, in the spring, to NSF from Purdue. There were more than that. 65 grants referenced PER as its data management plan and repository. And we received so far 6 of those grants, and they comment on the data management plan that we submitted as required by NSF. So that there's an incentive in the fact that as a grant is given to the university takes responsibility to accommodate and meet the expectations being placed on us by that granting agency, and that is to manage that data and to assure that it's going to be accessible. Now, did that answer all of your questions? Okay, thank you. I know it's me and lunch, so. I really enjoy talking about this. There's a question back there.
Lyndon Holmes, Aries. I'm intrigued by the commitment that Purdue is making to preservation of data sets. How do you, and I think it probably comes under your area, how do you assure or winnow accumulated data over time? Because it costs money.
Yes. We've done a lot of exploration on that. The business model is very critical to us. We've met with the federal auditing agencies to determine what we can include in our F&A rate, because F&A, of course, is dependent upon what the university can establish as a cost to support research. At Purdue, it's about 54% overhead. And it turns out that we're at the maximum for administration. So unless the federal government decides to allow us to increase how much we can charge to overhead to support this the management of data, we're not going to be able to do it. We're going to have to find the resources internally. When we've had conversations with NSF, they've told us, just as you, the university and NSF and the state and tuition and everything goes to support the libraries in the past, they need to be there to support the research data archiving and preservation. So the university has, in fact, we just came with a proposal to the university to show what it's going to take for us to do this into the future. It's not as expensive as we thought it might be. It's high, but it's not as expensive as we thought it would be. We have reassigned librarians. We no longer have an English subject specialist in the library. We now have a data research specialist. We have a data science implementation specialist. We have librarians who work specifically on integrating and assessing what the data needs are of disciplinary faculty, so that we have redefined what we do as librarians in order to stretch us and move us into the 21st century. So it's partly through additional support. And I have to say that by the fact that we're getting so involved in this, we get additional support from the administration. Purdue is a science engineering-oriented university. So by focusing and integrating us completely into the research that is going on at the university, we get additional support from the administration. I have 7 new positions in the libraries as librarians that we're filling right now, almost all of them related to data management and data support. We're also working very closely with the Office of Vice President for Research, Information Technology, and the libraries. PER, the repository that I mentioned, is run by a steering committee. I'm chair, but then the Vice President for Research and the Vice President for Information Technology are the other 2 members. And then we have a working group of people involved, sponsored programs, research office, IT, and libraries, all working together to make that happen. And every organization is doing it somewhat differently because it's a new area for libraries, and so we're all looking at it differently. DataCite is being implemented differently in every country. I was just in Australia, and they have a national library that is really providing the service to the researchers in Australia. So we're a little bit more challenged in the U.S. since federal funding is more difficult to obtain and probably will be more so in the future. But it requires a different model. It really does.
So at the DataCite meeting this summer, one of the more prevalent themes was the desire to evolve the citing of data, S-I-G-H-T, to the citing of data, C-I-T-E. Would you have any comment on how important that is to the goal of DataCite?
They're obviously directly related, because if you're not able to put the data in a repository, are you talking about preservation more or less?
I'm talking about reference citation attribution.
Yes, for the CITA, but for the SIGHT, you're talking about making sure you put the data someplace.
No, the theme that seemed to be very prevalent was the desire for recognition. For data site producers, for data producers to really rise to achieving the credit,
yes,
that's derived through, you know, reference citation.
Yes, no, that's exactly right. Because what if an article can be cited But if it's the underlying data, the one way I've heard it described very well is the published article is the best metadata to the underlying data because it really gives you the best insight into what that data is that it's underlying, that data set that is underlying it. And so that if someone is looking at, reading an article, a journal article, and they want to explore it more, typically, when we first started, when NSF first made their mandate that people had to share their data, we got comments from faculty saying, we already do that. And I would say, now, how do you do that? And they said, well, when some colleague writes me and emails me, I send it to him. And I said, that's not the intent here. The intent is to make this seamless, to make it so that people that don't know you, who don't have to take an initiative to contact you, and you don't have to take an initiative to respond, can get access to that data. And so it's the likelihood that that data is going to be of value to one researcher, 20 researchers, and how many times that research data has been cited, has been used, that then becomes an important element. We have, I'll not go over my 1:15 time, but when we first got involved in this, I would go out and sit down and talk to researchers. And as a librarian, my typical tendency is to try to understand everything they're talking about so that nothing could escape me. And so I would be sitting there listening to this researcher talking about Arabidopsis and the DNA of Arabidopsis, which is a plant, and it's the basic plant that they use for studying DNA of plants. And I was sitting there trying to listen to everything he was telling me, trying to take it all in, until finally I thought, I don't need to know about Arabidopsis. I just need to know what he needs to do with this data and what he needs to do to organize it. I need to be able to apply my library science skills to look at the whole and then take it and say, how do we organize this? How do we create structure in this? And then I finally asked him a question, is this going to be important in 5 years? And he said, yes. And I said, in 20 years? And he said, yes. And I said, 100 years? And he said, Jim, you might as well be asking about the human genome. This is as critical to plants as it is to the human genome was to humans. And he said, this will be important forever. So Purdue has that database, and we will be making a commitment nationally, internationally, to maintain that database for the worldwide access. The one challenge we have is, and it goes back to the business model, what if we develop this database that is incredibly important to researchers? Maybe it's Arabidopsis, but maybe it's aeronautics engineering. And we say, okay, we want to sell access to it. Now, I have to tell you that this is a discussion that's going on within my institution because people look at it and say, okay, why don't we make some money off of this? And I have to keep reminding them, okay, so we have this database in aeroastro or aeronautics. What if only 18 people in the world care about this database? But all of our other 2,000 faculty want to have access to all of these other databases that are also charging. I don't think we will come out ahead. We've got to be looking at this like libraries, and that libraries provide access to repositories of knowledge that we know that repository exists for the general good. And so that's what we're really kind of struggling with now, is who takes responsibility, who has the expectation of maintaining specific large data sets that will meet a particular need of a research community. I think that's going to be a real challenge. And that's a challenge for the disciplines, for the professional societies as well. Thank you.